Thanks for coming.
Good night, guys. It's great to see you again. Oh, man. I don't know when I've laughed so hard in my life. I mean, Kenny was on a roll tonight. I mean, I got to remember some of those jokes. They're hilarious. The guys at work are going to love them. And what about Jim and Yvonne? I mean, they were in rare form tonight, weren't they? Why do I feel like I'm having a one-way conversation? Great. Are you going to tell me what's wrong, or do I have to guess? Oh, great. I get to guess. Well, could you kind of grunt or something so I know when I get it right? I better sit down. I can tell this is going to be a long night. All right, let me think. What was it? It's got to be something I did. No, it was something I said. It's got to be something I said. It's always something that I said.
Do you enjoy carrying on a conversation by yourself?
Well, I happen to think I'm a pretty good conversationalist.
That makes one of us.
Oh, here it is. I knew it was something I said. All right, what was it?
Oh, if you don't know.
Oh, all right, the guessing game again.
So glad you find that humorous.
Susan, what is it with you? I mean, come on, we've been married 14 years and all of a sudden I can't do anything right.
It's not just anything. It's one particular, very important thing that I have asked you repeatedly not to do. And you just keep on doing it. And unfortunately, I have just perpetuated the problem because I have tolerated it all these years.
You're mad because I told them about you getting your hair stuck in the garbage disposal. Come on, I'm sorry, okay? I mean, but when Kenny was talking about how Leah almost burned her eyebrows off in the fireplace, I mean, I couldn't help it.
You know what? I know I do dumb things. I say even dumber things. Everybody does, but you don't have to tell the whole world about it.
Susan, come on, you're not dumb. They're just funny stories, okay? What's the matter with that little teasing?
Of your joke.
Well, tell them about all the dumb things I do. I mean, Yvonne was having a field day with Jim.
You know what? I know. Everyone makes fun of their spouse. It's a guaranteed laugh. Well, I'm sorry. I just don't happen to like it.
Susan, come on. It's just a little teasing. We're just having fun. All right. I'm sorry, okay? Truly. Truly sorry, okay? Susan, did you hear me? I said I was sorry.
Yeah, I heard you.
Well?
Well, what?
Well, do you forgive me?
No.
No?
No.
Why not?
Because I'm tired of forgiving you.
Susan!
What? Are you tired of apologizing?
No.
Well, yeah. That's obvious. You keep turning around and doing it all over again.
Susan, it's not a premeditated thing. I just get on a roll. It just happens.
I'm tired of it. I'm tired of it. And I'm tired of you. And I'm tired of your rote apology.
Oh, give me a break. I mean, now you act like you don't believe me when I apologize to you or something. Susan, it's just not easy. All right, old habits just die hard.
Oh, there's a snappy excuse. Remind me to use that one the next time I hurt you.
Well, what do you want me to do?
Did you ask me tonight if it would be okay to tell them that story? No. Have I told you to do that? Yes. Over and over and over again. But no, you don't want to lose a minute in the spotlight. Instead, you choose not just to tell the story, but embellish it, which makes me look like an even greater fool than I already am.
Susan, you're right. You're right. I should have asked. I realized that, and I didn't. Okay, I just forgot.
Oh, if I had a dime for every time I heard that.
What? What do you want me to do to prove to you that I'm really sorry?
Oh, don't bother. Just don't bother. I'm sick of it. I'm tired of it. I'm tired, Jerry, of always being the gracious forgiver. Again and again and again. A person has their limits.
Come on, Susan. You know, you're not being fair.
Oh, there's an interesting twist. Now I'm the bad guy because I can't forgive you anymore. Tell me, Jerry, just how many chances is a person supposed to get? My thoughts exactly.
Maybe you've avoided uncomfortable confrontations yourself. You easily ignored the obvious. The tension between you and your spouse, your children, your coworker, your client or friend. Maybe the elephant in the middle of your house was easy to walk around this week, or the person with such an obvious anger problem in your life was more contained than you're used to. So it seemed like the situation might actually become somewhat tolerable. Maybe conflict, from your perspective, isn't worth dealing with. But let me ask you, how are you doing really? How much do you despise the fact that the marriage you always dreamed of has turned into an awful misfortune that you never dreamed you would have to endure? How is it that you avoid at all costs a holiday, or for many even a conversation with a parent? How does it feel to have to walk around, work around the out-of-control people in your life that consistently intimidate you with their short views, their manipulations, and their threats? How lonely are you because your relationships rarely even show a shadow of intimacy, authenticity, or any kind of commitment to one another? How isolated are you because of conflicts that have spun out of control, or just as likely conflicts that you have purposely avoided because you are not the confrontational type? How sad to discover that no one really cares about you enough to love you with truth when they have conflict with you. How insignificant do you feel that no one cares to hold you accountable for your words, your emotions, your habits or patterns that are out of control? How painful is it to see that no one is so committed to you that they would risk everything to take a chance at loving you with the truth so that you can grow and so the two of you can enjoy the kind of relationship God intended for you to have? There's a story that is told of a office that had a little softball game every year between the accounting department and the marketing department. And this particular year, the accounting department destroyed the marketing department, but the marketing people got a hold of it. And they sent out a press release and posted it all around the office. This is what it said. The marketing department is pleased to announce that for the 2002 softball season, we came in second place. We only lost one game all year. The accounting department, however, had a rather dismal season, winning only one game. Let me just tell you what I'm about to do. I'm about to go on a 3-week marketing blitz on conflict. But I'm not going to disguise the truth or suppress the truth or reposition the truth in order to reposition conflict in your eye, in your worldview. What I want to do is give you a perspective on conflict that we don't often think about. I want to talk about conflict so straight on, so head on, and give you tangible things that you can do in sorting through your view of conflict as we weigh in on it today, and knowing what the work is that you have to do before you enter into a conversation that's difficult or a problem with another person. Next week, we're going to tear apart the idea of, okay, when you've done what you need to do, how do you begin that process of working through the conflict which exists in so many places? Conflict is everywhere. I just sat out and with very little effort, I just wrote down, conflict is there in race. It's there in Serbian and Croatian. It is black and white. It is Arab and Jew. Conflict is there in gender, male and female, in generation, young and old. It's in politics, Republicans versus Democrats, conservative versus liberal, left versus right. It's in worldview, your relativist and your nihilist, your relativist versus your absolutist. Your nihilist and your fatalist versus those who have hope in the idea of a God who is and a God who is committed to those that He's created.
There's conflict in religion. Catholic versus Protestant. Grace versus works. Atheist versus theist. Monotheist versus polytheist. There's conflict everywhere. Brother versus brother. Husband versus wife. Child versus parent. Family versus family. Employer versus employee. Management versus labor. Corporation versus mom and pop. Neighbor versus neighbor. Ex-friend versus ex-friend. You cannot avoid conflict. You can deny it. You can run from it. You can use it as a club or as an opportunity to club somebody that has offended you, but you cannot ignore conflict. And it's not just the Hatfields and McCoys. You know, for this little series, I just went and looked back. Do you know what the conflict that was the Hatfields and McCoys? Did any of you ever went back and looked at that? I can't say that I have until I was getting ready for this. The Hatfields and McCoys, which is really the paradigm of what conflict is all about for us. The world, it's the Arab versus the Jew. In America, you say Hatfields and McCoys, you know you got two people that are just coming at each other. Do you know what that thing was all about? A misunderstanding over a pig. The Hatfields, who lived on the West Virginia side of a river, and the McCoys, who lived on the Kentucky side of the river. One day, Mr. McCoy accused Mr. Hatfield of misappropriating one of his pigs. And Mr. Hatfield was highly offended. And it just escalated until 13 different Hatfields and McCoys were slaughtered. Most of them the children of the two original men that could not work out their misunderstanding. Seven Hatfields, other than the 13 that were murdered, were sentenced to a life in prison. It wasn't just the Hatfields and McCoys. The states got involved. The governors of the state of Kentucky and the governors of the state of West Virginia got in a big war over the fact that at one point some folks from Kentucky raided into West Virginia and extricated some of the Hatfields in order to prosecute them in Kentucky. And the case went all the way to the Supreme Court of the United States. Do you know that? The National Guard was called in to maintain civility between the two states because of a misunderstanding over a pig. But it's not just the Hatfields and McCoys. It is all of us and everywhere. And I'm going to dare say that it's such an epidemic. I think that this, as much as anything, both inside communities like ours, the community of faith, and outside in the world, there is nothing as severe in its consequence as the misappropriation and misguided attitudes towards conflict. And so we're going to commit 3 weeks to it. And I want to let you know that I am committed in the next 3 weeks to change your view of conflict so much that instead of viewing it as something you avoid at all costs or something that you use any tactics at all to win, you in fact begin to see it as your greatest opportunity to do three different things: to serve people, to grow yourself, and ultimately to glorify God. You need to know the Bible is straightforward about conflict. It doesn't suppress it. It's not embarrassed about it. And to be in conflict is not sin. Though often sin is the root cause of conflict. But the views that we have and the tactics that we employ often darken our hearts and threaten our very existence. Well, let's go. I want to let you guys know I am radical about this. I am a maniac about conflict. If you work with me at Watermark, you know this. There are three things that we expect of everybody that we hire. First of all, that they have professional competency or professional trust with us. When we sit down and brainstorm a way to start to communicate something, if you're in the arts department, you better be able to deliver a video, music, drama that helps set up where we're going to go. We've got to be able to trust you in that. And you see why. With Linda and Kyle and Paul and their team, there's incredible professional trust between us. Spiritual trust with what we do. We won't hire somebody if we don't believe that what they are about is what we ultimately are about, which is to live in an authentic relationship with God, honest about our struggles and our sometimes confusion about how to walk best to glorify Him. But we are committed to that end and aren't just acting like we love God in order to maintain a job. There is an authentic relationship and there is a spiritual trust and a commitment to go forward that must be there for us to to work together. And lastly, there's got to be relational trust. I will not employ somebody that allows conflict to go underground. Or I will not leave them employed long. I am a freak about conflict. I spend hours every week working through the misunderstandings, misperceptions, and sometimes errors that create conflict in my family, in our office, and in this community of faith. Because I see conflict by the grace of God the way I want you to see it at the end of these 3 weeks. It is our greatest opportunity to serve one another, to grow and learn ourselves, and to glorify our Father. Let's start weighing in on conflict, and let's start by taking a look at a verse which guides us in how we must see this whole thing. Here we go. Round one. Weighing in on conflict. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 3. Here we go. All right, here comes my card, girl. Come on, Lance. You want to do it for me? Show it. Oh, no, the card girl's having a meltdown. All right. Thank you. See, you want to come out and show everybody the card? Nope. Okay. There she is, ladies and gentlemen, our card girl. See you, Landry. All right. Felt like we could get away with that one anyway. Walking out. Ephesians 4:3. Here's what it says. That we are to be diligent, especially those of us who are part of the household of faith. We are to be diligent to preserve the unity of the Spirit that God has created for those of us that are in this family of faith. And we know that today there are many guests that are here. And you don't know what unity is really all about. But I want you to know this, that God wants you to experience oneness with other people. Anything that threatens community is subversive and rebellious to God's intended plan. God's goal is oneness and community. In His very essence, God is absent of conflict and love and submission and unity is a very part of the nature of who God is. The Scripture says that God made us to be in His image. And one of the things that God wanted us to do is to walk in love together. This verse right here in Ephesians 4:3 follows after Paul said, look, in view of all the things that have happened in your life, walk worthy of the calling with which you have been called. In humility and gentleness with one another. With patience and tolerance. In love. Showing forbearance to one another. Being diligent. There it is. To preserve unity and oneness. And to not let isolation slip in. God is desperate for you to experience relationship that even when conflict enters in, that you work hard and use biblical principles and things that He has given us that we couldn't figure out on our own to help us have the relationship that all of us in our heart of hearts desires. Yes, some of you have avoided conflict and felt like you got away with it this last week. But how are you doing really? How are you doing really? Let me tell you something else God says about conflict. It comes in Matthew chapter 5, verse 9. And when God is, the very first time He's spoken, for 400 years He's been silent, He comes crashing onto the scene. And He's going to lay out some truth for people that they've never heard before. And He starts by saying, blessed are those who are peacemakers. About six sentences into His very first message. For people that are peacemakers, that take the conflict that is there, and that go forward with it and go through with it in a way that models God's own view of conflict. That's who God's sons are. There's all different kinds of ways to view conflict. Now I want to just walk you through a couple of different responses that we sometimes have towards conflict. There's what's called the escape strategies. Some of you deal with conflict in this way. In fact, these three most fully characterize the way people who sit in buildings like this often come at it. It's the church's way of dealing with conflict most often. We see conflict as something to be avoided at all costs, and it's a real tragedy. We deny it, which works for a little bit, but ultimately leaves us longing for authentic relationships. We deny the problem we've got with that spouse. We deny the problem we've got with that staff person, that other folk in our community group. We deny the fact that our neighbor is really a jerk or our employer is unjust in the way that he treats us. But resentment will build up and it always makes its way out. And so what some people do when they can't handle that, they slide a little bit further down than they ever intended to. And all of a sudden they find themselves withdrawing or they fly away. They move back away from the relationship that initially they thought would bring them joy. And then the ultimate expression for some people to run away from the conflict that's in their hearts and in this world is they just terminate themselves. There's a lot of people that never thought they would get to that response to conflict. But they enter on this slippery slope on the escape side and they find themselves having just denied there was a problem to all of a sudden running from life's problems to all of a sudden realizing that the only hope that they've left themselves is the lie that maybe there's some peace at the grave. Folks, this is not peacemaking. This is what is properly called peace faking. And peace fakers are all around us. And they deny conflict. And they run from conflict. Sometimes even to the point of eliminating their own chance to deal with it. Well, let me show you another one. These are not escape tendencies as much as they're attack responses to conflict. And like the first one, there is a slippery slope here. And I want to show you the correlation to what we just saw. Some people, when there's a conflict, they really don't focus on them and deny and withdraw, but they focus on you. And they think that you're the problem. And so their view of conflict, and these are not peacemakers either. These are peace breakers. They will come into a conflict, and when it gets there, they're going to go, I'm going to teach you not to do that to me again. And they litigate. Some people would tell you that litigation is nothing more than professionally assisted denial. Where in fact, litigation does not allow you to deal with the attitudes and behaviors that create the conflict. What they often do is reinforce you that you are completely right in your view of conflict. And they argue for your side totally without giving any sense of a crack in your armor. And they assist you in your denial by telling you that that person is the problem. It's an attack response. Well, what's the opposite of flight? You've heard this before. This is the way most people deal with conflict. And one of two extremes, both completely unbiblical and equally as damaging to your psyche and to our existence as a race, as a people. You either run from it as fast as you can or you take it head on and you fight till you win. We call it assault. Most often, in circles like this, assault looks verbal. People will slander about you. They will gossip about you. If you come at me, or we have got conflict, I'm going to teach you not to have conflict with me, because my tongue will wear you out. And if you come at me with an issue I don't like, I'm going to punish you. Sometimes it escalates to threats, and sometimes to physical intimidations. And then lastly, you see the same extreme. This slippery slope also ends in death. With murder. Now, most of us have never gotten this far in conflicts that are in this room. But one of the things that the Lord said when he was here is that if you look at a brother with contempt in your heart and you call him Raka, which was a euphemism for the day for you blockhead or you idiot or you stupid, he said you're guilty of murder. See, most of us never want to go that far, but it is a slippery slope when you move off the center of what peacemaking is, and you slide slowly towards peace faking or take the attack response of peace breaking, it ends up often in places we never thought it would. Some of you guys have your own Hatfield and McCoy that are out there tonight. Some of y'all are still married to your Hatfield or your McCoy. Some of you haven't shared a Christmas or Thanksgiving with your Hatfield or McCoy, and just as painful, some of you spend one every year and it makes you sick because it's nothing like you know it should be. And so what we want to do is we want to give you some principles over these next couple of weeks that will help you be a peacemaker, to be a child of God. This is the things that it will look like. And we'll teach you about when do you overlook an offense and when is it too small to overlook. When you do go to somebody to discuss it, what are some things that you ought to do? How do you negotiate? In other words, how do you take the issues that that person might understand that you've not understood that will explain the conflict? And when you can't get it together between the two of you, What does mediation look like? And is it biblical? And what's arbitration? In fact, where does church discipline fit in on this issue of conflict? We're going to change your worldview if we do what we set out and are praying that we can do. And we're going to put conflict in a whole new light in your life. I hear again and again and again from people, I'm just not the confrontational type. Man, Wagner, you're good at that. You go have that conversation. But I'm just not the confrontational type. Well, I got news for you. If you're not a person that is committed to rolling out and dealing with conflict in a biblical way, you're not the friend of God type. And it's not about your temperament. It's not about your bent. But there are simple principles and strategies that will bless you. And frankly, whether you ever come to a saving grace relationship with God or not, these 3 weeks can be useful to you in navigating your way in the course of this world. But we pray that in the hope of understanding the wisdom that God has for you and experiencing life right now, that you might consider Him as Lord, not just of the ring of conflict, but Lord of your life. This is what it says in Psalm 37. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. We are compelled to go and to be places where we say, you know, trust God's way to deal with life. Don't resort to your own ways or lean on your own understanding. But in all your ways, acknowledge Him. He'll make your path straight. But notice the word that God has for you there. He wants you to dwell someplace and cultivate what's appropriate and what is faithful. What most of us do is we don't dwell, we either take off as soon as stuff gets difficult, or we don't cultivate, we destroy if it gets difficult. And we teach people to never give us problems again. Let me just walk you through a little bit of God's purpose for marriage and show you that the way that He wants us to relate in marriage is a perfect model for how we deal with all of our relationships. Parent, child, neighbor to neighbor, employer and employee. Here we go. This is God's purpose for us in marriage, that we would bring about completeness and oneness with one another. In fact, the scriptures talk about the fact that in each other's lives, we are to be iron to iron and to sharpen one another. That's your role in my life and my role in your life is to make us more useful and effective people. More God-like, more Christ-like. What God calls the woman to be is a completer. In Genesis 2:18, He says to the man, this is your wife. She is to be your helpmate or your completer, and to love you and to serve you and to work with you and to help you be the man that I want you to be. To the woman, He says, this is man. I give him to you as a gift, and he will dwell with you, and he will nourish you and honor you and cherish you and bring forth blessing in your life. That is God's intended purpose for marriage. But let me show you what most of us do in the midst of marriage. We don't become peacemakers who stay there and complete and dwell. For women, one expression of peace breaking is they say to this man that's not cherishing them and loving them the way that he said that he would on the altar. All right, big boy, you want to come at me that way? Then I'm going to come at you. And we're going to compete here for who's going to treat who, which way. And a woman will take on a role that God never intended her to take, which is to compete not just for headship of the family, but for emotional control in that relationship. And she'll use every manipulative tactic that she can. If it's sex, she'll roll it out. If it's a silent treatment, she'll roll it out. But she'll teach that guy to not do what she doesn't like done. And if she's good enough at it, he will cower and begin to act as she is intended for him to. Now, men, when they're peace breakers, what they do is they go to the woman and say, look, you want to go on, throw down with me? You want to not be the woman that I think I need to be happy? Then let's get after it. And a man will try and dominate the woman, often physically, very often verbally, and wear her down and abuse her. And instead of dwelling there with her and tilling the soil of her heart and serving her and loving her in a way that she can respond with joy, he'll intimidate her into being the kind of woman that he thinks he wants. That's peace breaking. And we do the exact same thing in relationships with other people. If they're not going to be what I want them to be and bring joy in my life, then I will compete with them for who's going to survive, and I will dominate them. You'll see this expression, and I see more women in our body do this, and too many men in our body do this, as a peace-faking solution in marriage. Like our couple in the play tonight, they will just begin to condone each other's behavior. Or she'll say, "For you know, it's my fault, because for 14 years I've just tolerated this." But all of a sudden, what did she do? She took a different tactic this night. And she went up and said, "I'm going to compete with you. I'm going to punish you because you're not dwelling with me and cultivating faithfulness and love in my heart." And too many of us condone behavior. We deny its existence, and so we condone it and go, "It's better than most people have it." Or typically what the men does, instead of staying there and working hard and dwelling and cultivating and fertilizing the heart, if they're not getting produce from that wife that they want, the emotional strength, the physical satisfaction there, they'll desert her and go somewhere else where they don't have to work so hard. Now, people, this isn't just about marriage these 3 weeks, but I want to show you that what God wants us to do is to complete each other, which is to insinuate that we are not done, to dwell with each other and to trust God as we dwell with each other in how we deal with the conflict, which so obviously and easily comes about. Now, let me just be very honest with you. This isn't going to necessarily always be easy, but it's a very difficult thing that leads to life and leads to an easier life. And it's not the easy thing which ultimately leads to a very hard life. The Bible uses two words in the New Testament for conflict. I'm going to put them up. I know you're not Greek scholars, but I bet you get some insight just by looking at them. These are the two words in the New Testament that are used for conflict. Now, knowing that we get many of our words in our language from the ancient languages of Latin and Greek specifically, what two words do you see in our language that look strongly familiar to them? Of course, the first one, which is athlesis up there, we get the word athlete from. One who competes or one who fights. And the other one, agon, we get the word agony from. It's interesting, conflict is a noun always in the New Testament, and it's used once by Paul and once in the book of Hebrews. And both times it talks about conflict as something. The Olympics that are coming up in Greece here, in 2004. There we go. I know they'll be here. In 2004, in Greece, we'll be at the Agon. That is the Greek word for stadium or place where they would hold their national games, where competitors would go in there and compete, and one would win and one would lose. And there would be agony in their striving to win. And God's very honest about this. Conflict is at times agonizing. And conflict takes a lot of work. Just like competing to win as an athlete takes a lot of work. And the very easy thing to do is to avoid it. But it becomes a hard way to live. And the very hard thing to do is to get in the ring, to get in the agon, and to take it on and to see if you can win. What I want to talk about today specifically is what is the most difficult part of all conflict. And you're going to be surprised as to what you think, what I think it is. The most agonizing thing for you in conflict, the thing that will take you the most self-discipline in conflict, is taking a look at your part in it. I call this the fight before the fight. About 10 days ago, I was with Ed Too Tall Jones. He used to be an all-pro lineman with the Dallas Cowboys. And he and I were together, and we were talking about a number of different things. And his boxing career came up. And I was talking to Ed about what we were going to do here for the next couple of weeks. And so I started just quizzing him a little bit about his boxing career. We didn't talk football. We didn't talk anything else. I just said, let's talk boxing. Ed Jones, if you don't know, was 6-0 as a professional boxer. He had some success. It was a time when the heavyweight boxing field was vacant, a real superstar. It was just before Tyson kind of came on the scene that first time, or maybe had fallen off and was in prison. I forget exactly which one. But Ed Too Tall Jones had a real opportunity. And he was 6-0 and had a chance to keep moving up the ranks and possibly have a crack at some, you know, significant bout. And I said, "Why did you get out if you never lost?" And his exact words in response for me is, "I got out because the training was too hard on my body and too tough. And I didn't want that." Notice what he said. He said, I was sick of getting my nose popped. Nope. He didn't say I was sick of the threat of getting my jaw broken in the ring. Nope. He said the most difficult part of boxing was the preparation. I said, you couldn't have given me a better line. Because we're going to talk for 3 weeks about conflict. And everybody wants to avoid conflict. But I'm going to tell you, the reason that most people think they don't want to get in conflict is they're afraid Mike Tyson's going to take their head off in the ring. And Mike Tyson isn't near as scary to face as your own heart. And today, for the next few minutes, I want to just look at our call and our responsibility to look at our own heart. Jesus says it this way. He says, don't judge lest you yourself will be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged, and by your standard of measure will be measured to you. Why do you look at the speck that is in your brother's eye, but don't notice the log that's in your own? How can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, and behold, the log is in your own eye? And let me just make a couple of quick comments about this. Jesus is clearly using hyperbole, which is a way to exaggerate something to make it a point. And what he's saying is, look, you've got to deal with a huge chunk of wood that's in your own life. But he does in many ways insinuate that we're not somehow responsible for looking at what's in each other's eye and dealing with it. He does say, look, deal with the speck in your brother's eye. But he says to do that effectively, you can't do something as intricate as eye surgery if you yourself are obstructed with a major problem. Let me just lay it out for you again. As we weigh in on conflict, as we talk about the fight before the fight, and next week we talk about how to go to a brother or a sister, what I want to do today is challenge you with the most difficult part of conflict, which is evaluating your own part in it. The most difficult part is seeing your part. There's two different ways that we've got to look at the log in our own eye. We got to check out our attitudes. We got to check out our actions. In other words, we can be overly critical, negative, or too sensitive, or we can be, at times, our actions can cause conflict and part of the problem with our actual words and deeds. These are two aspects of logs in our life that we've got to look for. Let me just talk about that first one for a second, the attitudes. Because sometimes we've got some really good desires, but when they are elevated to God's place, they can be causes for conflict. Let me say it again. Good desires elevated to God's place are often the causes for conflict. What do I mean by this? I mean, we all know that sinful attitudes, in other words, wanting to bend another person's will, wanting to conceal truth, or wanting revenge, we know that that is an attitude that we cannot have. But there are some good desires that all of us have that we can elevate to the wrong place that cause conflicts that we've got to be honest about. Let me give you an example. Craving to be understood to the place that it becomes insatiable to us. And we will not rest until that person arrives at a place where they will give us what we need, which is some form of validation, blessing, or vindication. Let me say it again. Good desires that we elevate to being the thing that we need to be satisfied in life, to have peace and joy, can often be the cause of conflict. In other words, if I want you to like me, if I want you to acknowledge that my life is valuable, and I don't get from you what I want to get from you, I will just incessantly come at you. And if you don't give me what I want, sometimes I'll just go over here and I will salt you with my words and try and tear you down and make you unimportant and insignificant in my life so that I won't have to feel bad about the fact that you don't give me what I want. But I've got to look at that log in my eye of what is really driving me here in this conflict with this person. Do I want to be vindicated publicly? Because that's a wrong and sinful attitude. My ultimate vindication, the Scripture says, should come before God alone. Now, it's a natural desire to want to be seen for who you are when who you are is a good thing. But when we make that our motivating force in life, that will cause great conflict with one another. Craving for meaning, understanding, or life from anything other than God is a great source of conflict. What I want to do is just walk now through for a few minutes of what to do when you come to the place where by the grace of God, as you've just stood before Him, and you said, you know, I acknowledge that there's some issues in my life. I've looked at my attitudes. I've taken some time alone and I've evaluated my actions, my words, and the things that I've done. I've brought trusted friends around me and I've tried to explain to them my part in this conflict, and they've helped me see some things. And I've done the very hard, agonizing work of preparing for conflict. What do you do? What do you do? For you to be ready to step into the bout in the ring that we're going to talk about next week, you have got to be at the place where you can do these seven things. I'm going to give them to you in A's. And I'm going to show you right down through the Scriptures how these are little simple things that God has given us that will allow us to know that we're ready to step into the ring of conflict. First of all, I am committed to address everyone that's involved. I've looked at the log in my own eye. I've seen where the conflict is. I've checked my own attitudes. I've evaluated my actions. And I'm not going to go run and tell everybody else. If they're not a part of the problem or they're not a part of the solution, then I'm not going to bring them into it at this point. I'm going to go directly to the individuals that I know that I'm in conflict with. And I'm going to talk to them specifically. And I'm going to talk to them about me and where I am. There's great biblical exhortation towards this. In Proverbs chapter 6, this talks about specifically when you have put yourself in a position where you have co-signed on a high interest loan with somebody that you didn't know very well. Or maybe that you did. And you realize it wasn't a very wise decision, that what you did was foolish. This is what it says. If you've been snared with the words of your mouth, if you've been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, deliver yourself. Since you've come into the hand of your neighbor, go and humble yourself. You importune, you plead, you throw yourself before your neighbor. You give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. You deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand, like a bird from the hand of a fowler. What's the imagery there? If you're a gazelle and a hunter is right there, what's that gazelle going to do? He is going to hightail it. He's going to go quickly and a bird's going to fly away from the snare of the fowler because he wants to survive. And what the Scriptures are exhorting you to do when you come to a place where you realize that you're in conflict with another and you have examined your heart, you don't delay. You don't give rest to your eyelids or sleep to your eyes. You get after it. And you address everybody that's involved and you go to them and you do everything that you can to say, this is who I am. The second thing you do is you walk right up and you say, look, I'm going to avoid my if, my buts, and my maybes. We saw our friend in our little drama a little bit earlier, sitting right here. And what did he do? He sat and he was trying to figure out what to do. I've done that before. And most of the time when I'm sitting here, my thoughts are that woman in the other room is driving me nuts. And I want to think about all the splinters in her eye. And I don't want to deal with the logs on my own because I'm just not ready to do that hard work yet. I want to teach her a lesson. I want to dominate her. Or sometimes I just want to desert the area. Go somewhere where I can get love easier. But the few times that I've realized that there's a conflict there and that oneness is what's intended for us, and I walk in, there's lots of times when I don't do the second thing. And I go re-engage with that girl in the other room. And I go, look, if I've offended you, or, you know, maybe I should have done some things differently. Or, you know, what I just did was wrong, but man, you just have got to give me a little more grace because when you did this, it just made me respond this way. And I'm just chopping myself down as I go in there to build her up. Let me just show you a biblical example of the right way to do it. In Luke chapter 15, there's a young man who came to his senses. And he said to himself, look, I'm in a place that even my father's servants are treated better than I am. And I know that I've messed up against my father. And what I'm going to do, in verse 18, he says, I will get up, I will go to my father, and I will say, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in your sight. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired men. He saw the log in his own eye. And in verse 20, it says, he got up, came to his father. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion for him and ran and embraced and kissed him. And the son said to the father, Father, if I have made a mistake or maybe it wasn't good that I took all my inheritance and squandered it. No, that's not what he said. He said, Father, I have sinned against heaven and in your sight. No ifs, maybes, or buts about it. I just want to tell you, this is the log in my life. And it's created a conflict between you and I. And I own it 100%. You avoid the ifs, buts, and maybes. You admit specifically what you do whenever possible. And I told you, think about not just your actions, but your attitudes. And this is where it takes some time. Before you get ready to go, the hardest part of boxing is the preparation for the match. The hardest part of winning conflict biblically is being an individual who's willing to stew the hard work and to think specifically, what did they do? See, our friend in this little drama again had a hard time seeing his problem. He thought his wife was just too sensitive. She just didn't have fun. She didn't have a sense of humor. He couldn't see the log in his own eye, and it drove her away. But he knows he doesn't like to be made fun of. He knows he doesn't like to have other people have a good time at his expense. And to walk in that room and to say, I'll tell you exactly what I did. I used you to build me up. I did not cherish you. I didn't dwell with you and cultivate faithfulness and bring forth security in your life. I stepped on you for my own glory. And it was dead wrong. You know, for me to do this well, and one of the things my wife and I often do when we get to a place where there's conflict in our relationship and we're just not making much progress is we just say, all right, well, let's get some room here. But that doesn't mean that she goes in and reads a book and I go turn on SportsCenter. We go and get alone and we just start to say, God, you got to deal with me because right now the problem in this household, if you're talking from the male perspective, is the female. If you're talking from the female perspective, it's the male. And I've got to get to the place where I am consumed with my participation in this conflict. I often pray this prayer. It's found in Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24, where I say, God, would you just search me and would you know my heart? And in knowing my heart and my anxious thoughts and the hurtful ways within me, would you expose it to me so that I have a chance to go in that room directly to her, not tell anybody what a hag I've got for a wife, but go to her, not have an if, a but, or maybe, and admit as specifically as I can what I did that's caused the conflict in our relationship. Once I get there and God showed that to me, I need to own it. Here's another A. I apologize. And by that, I mean I express some sorrow. There's a story in Matthew. We're not going to have time to go there, but it talks about an individual that just throws himself at the face of the king that he was guilty before. He prostrated himself and grieved at his state. And just said, you know, I am a sorry individual. We talked about this at the men's breakfast not long ago, where we just simply said to folks, you know what, when you say I am sorry, what are you supposed to do with that? What you're really saying when you're saying I am sorry, and it's a part of apologizing, is that you are yourself a sorry excuse for what a husband should be, a neighbor should be, an employer should be, or an employee should be. And I acknowledge before you that I am a sorry employee, a sorry neighbor. I've been a sorry friend. And it causes me grief and sorrow. Not only am I sorry for what I did, but there is sorrow in my life as I've realized that what I just did has brought conflict where I want there to be unity. But you don't just stop at the apology. Because sometimes when somebody just goes, okay, you've just declared that you're sorry and you've just declared that you've got pain. What am I supposed to do for that? You throw this at them. You take the next step and you ask for forgiveness. This is the one step that I believe that most people leave out in doing the hard work of looking at yourself and what you've got to do that makes stepping into the ring with somebody else exceedingly futile. We don't ever give them any opportunity to come back and move towards us. We don't ever lay our heads in the lap and say, this is what I have done. This is my contribution. This is where I've sinned against you by having an unhealthy expectation or wanting you to be this role in my life that only God should be in. And I need to ask your forgiveness. Will you forgive me? In other words, I am at your mercy. I am guilty. Now listen, that doesn't deny the fact that they may be guilty of far more. But this right now is not about their log or their splinter. It's about your log. It's about dwelling or completing. And what God says is you go into a conflict with somebody else. You do everything that you can on your side. You initiate to the person that's involved. You avoid if, buts, and maybes. You admit specifically. You apologize and you ask forgiveness. David did this, Psalm 51, where he just lays it out. Oh God, according to your loving kindness, according to the greatness of your compassion, you blot out my transgressions. You wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions. And this is where David, in this psalm, is dealing with what he had just done with Bathsheba and Uriah, where he murdered a man because he coveted his wife. And he says, God, against you and you only have I sinned, and against you and you only do I need forgiveness. You go and you ask forgiveness, and then you do what a man does. You accept the consequences. You want to do the hard thing in conflict? When you go and you've got a part in conflict, you just say, look, I'm asking you to forgive me, but that doesn't mean that I don't still have the consequences. In the Scriptures, when you sinned against somebody and you realize it, or when the world pointed it out to you, if you didn't realize it, you were to make restitution of 20% more than whatever the cost was to that individual. It was just the law. If you took $100 from them and that created the conflict, then you give them $120 and you accept the consequences when you see what you had done. If in fact Hatfield had stolen the pig from McCoy, you give him one big old sow and you give him a couple of piglets. And you don't ask somebody to just move away from that. And you take it like a man. And the Scriptures say, when you take it like a man, or when you take it like an adult, and you bear up under the wrong that you have done, it is not considered any great glory to you. It's what you ought to do. And so when you've got conflict in your relationship with your wife, you've got to realize sometimes, or with your neighbor, or that brother that you've offended, you accept the consequences that it's going to take you some time to rebuild that trust before any kind of intimacy is appropriate. And you don't demand that they pretend like nothing ever happened. But you do the last A, which is you alter your behavior. And as you alter your behavior and doing the hard work with your own life, this is about me and not about them, you're going to start to see a softening in this conflict you've never imagined. When Jesus came with the woman at the well, and he said, where are those that condemn you? She said, they've all gone away. And Jesus said, I don't condemn you either, but you go and stop this thing which is causing the conflict. Now, folks, none of us go forward from any kind of conflict and become perfect. I certainly haven't. In the ways that I've hurt people, I've hurt them in similar ways again. But the distance between my grievances and the distance between my errors and the severity of those errors lessen as I avail myself to God and ask Him to help me alter my behavior. This isn't in my own flesh. And this is where the only chance that we've got to ultimately work through conflict and to minimize conflict in our life is to be individuals who realize that there's a conflict going on within inside of us. The things that we know are right, we don't choose to do. And the very things I hate, I find myself doing. Scott did a great job with that a couple of weeks ago, talking about the battle between the spirit and the flesh and the conflict within, and how God alone can deal with that conflict in our hearts. And the only way to alter your behavior is to take a good hard look at who is running your life and see God not just as the Lord of the ring of conflict, but the Lord of all in your life. This is what it says in Romans chapter 12, verse 1 and 2. I urge you, therefore, brethren, by the mercy of God, in light of all that He has done, present yourself and your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice, which is acceptable to God, as a spiritual service of worship, or as a right response to what God has done. And then he says what? In light of what God has done and the forgiveness that you've received there and the mourning that you've done in light of your sin, alter your behavior. Don't be conformed to the world, but transform yourself by the renewing of your mind that you might prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. As we start this little 3-week thing on conflict, I want to just start it by throwing you a bit of a curve. And that is by saying, you know what? Most of the time, what we want to do is go change that person and fix what's wrong with them. And what the Lord says, you want to have successful conflict resolution? Start with your log. Start with your attitudes. Start with your behavior. You go to them. Acknowledge what you did. I'll deal with them and what they did. And I'm going to talk to you about what happens when you have just taken 100 from somebody and they've taken a million from you. God can handle that. And He speaks to it specifically. He tells you what to do. When you have done all that you can do and as much as you are able, you're at peace with those individuals, what do you do next? We're going to deal with that in the weeks that are ahead. But for today, I challenge you with the most difficult part of conflict, and that is the conflict within. And the hard work that you've got to do in your own heart. And so we're going to just have one song of application. And what I want you to do is you think about conflicts that you're in. No matter how slight or how severe, we all need these things to take place. We need to get the log out of our own eye and think for how we can go to those people and walk through those things and begin to alter our behavior towards them so that God might work a miracle there. And we're going to ask God to break our hearts. Let's pray together. Fathers, we just take on this huge topic that is conflict. And as we see that it's something that you're very clear on, that you don't act like it shouldn't be there. You tell us conflict's going to come. It's part of the course of this world. But you tell us that there's a way that we can deal with the conflict that's there. That's going to bring about grace in the life of those that we're in conflict with. It's going to grow us up to be the men and women that you want us to be. Where we can be image bearers of you. And we can imitate you. And even as you did all that you could do and more in conflict, that you had no sin and done no harm to us, you still saw an opportunity, and so you initiated and you entered into our conflict. And you offered a means through which we could receive forgiveness from you. And you didn't come at us as a peacebreaker, but as a peacemaker. And you offered up your Son as a means through which our rebellion against you could be forgiven and the conflict could be solved. Lord, I know there's some people in this room that need to come to you directly and address you, avoiding ifs, buts, and maybes about their condition in life. Admit specifically the things that they know that they have done that have caused you pain. To mourn over those things and then to ask you forgiveness. But that's where the drain of A stops with you. Except to acknowledge the consequence of their sin was you dying on the cross for them. And to accept the fact that their rebellion, like mine personally, was the cause for you to die on a tree. And for the log in my eye, you were nailed to a log. And I pray, Lord, that as I deal with that and find hope there with my friends, as you break our hearts, that we would alter our behavior and it would spill over to conflict that we have with each other. And that we would then begin to be image bearers. And take responsibility to move forward, and that you again, Father, would break our hearts.